Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Welcome to the LSE. My name is Sandy Pepper. I am a professor of management practice, which means that I had a former job before I ceased practicing. So I used to be the head of the HR services practice at PwC. Life is full of acronyms. But we're really here to welcome Joshua. Josh, he says that only his mother calls him Joshua, so I'm going to call him Josh.
Josh, when she's angry, specifically.
When she's angry. Yeah. So Josh Graf. Josh is the UK country manager and VP for EMEA, Europe, Middle East and Africa at LinkedIn. Josh is going to tell us a little bit about LinkedIn in a few minutes, and then we're going to have a conversation about the LinkedIn business. But I need just to do one or two other things before we get on to the main event. I need to thank Cohesion, who are sponsoring this event this evening. I also want to tell you a little bit about the HR alumni group. And forgive me if I'm going to read this, because I think this is an advertising pitch and it's quite important that I do it properly. So the HRM group is a forum for all LSE alumni who work in HR and related sectors to connect, interact, and network in the UK and internationally. The group has proved to be an influential voice in the debate, reflection, and analysis of trending themes, topical research, and future practice of HR and its impact. And they actively work to raise the visibility of the HR professions, facilitate best practice through a series of events like this, and to bring together key influencers, thought leaders, and experts. So I hope if you are not already a member of the HR alumni group, you will think about joining. I gather we have alumni here from as far back as 1969, which is very impressive. We also have some current students who probably weren't born in 1969. So a few housekeeping rules. Importantly, I want you to know that the event is being recorded. So if you say anything outrageous, you will probably find it on the front page of the Sunday Times at the weekend. Please could you switch off any mobile phones that you have switched on? I've just remembered to do that myself. There are no fire alarms planned this evening, you'll be pleased to hear. That means if the fire alarm does go off, you need to get out quickly. There's one exit. If we land on water, the inflatable chutes will come out of the side of the door, and you'll find a life jacket under your seat. Well, the last bit's not true, but nobody laughed. Okay, so Josh, would you like just to say a little few words about yourself and what you do before we move into the main event?
Sure. With pleasure. Can I do one thing? Can I move the table out there, actually?
You can.
Thanks. There we go. That's better. So my name is Josh. I have two roles at LinkedIn. The first role is that I'm the UK country manager, and the second role is that I lead our marketing solutions business, which is our advertising business across Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. I joined in March 2011. I was about employee number 800. We're now approximately 9,500. So it's grown pretty substantially since I joined the company, just coming up on 6 years ago. Based in London, always been based in London. Sort of prior to LinkedIn, I spent a few years at Electronic Arts, the games company. And prior to that, through a series of acquisitions, ended up at Microsoft. Sort of when the deal closes, that will be a deja vu for me. I think that's the...
Good, that's great introduction. So shall we start? Would you like to say a few words of introduction, and you can play your slide deck and then we'll have our conversation.
Sure. I was going to show you a slide deck. Well, I still can to some degree, but there's three or four slides, so I can put them to one side and just talk to them. I wanted to start off by sharing with you just a brief overview of LinkedIn's mission, the vision, and how that vision manifests itself on a day-to-day basis. So I think in some organizations, the mission, the vision is written on the wall. It's maybe on a piece of paper during the induction and shoved in your desk drawer. And at LinkedIn, we take it very seriously. It is our true north in many respects. It's what guides many of the decisions that we take on a day-to-day basis. The mission at LinkedIn is to connect the world's professionals to make them more productive and more successful. And when I say connect the world's professionals, by our estimates, there's about 780 million professionals around the globe, and there's 467 million on LinkedIn today. So we're about two-thirds of the way there. First step is about connecting people, and secondly, about making them more productive and more successful. And I will come back to that in greater detail later on. As a result of being able to see that mission in terms of being able to connect the world's professionals, it's important for us to extend that even further and have a more aspirational vision. And so that vision is to be able to create economic opportunity for every member of the global workforce. And in the global workforce today, there's approximately 3.2 billion people. So pretty aspirational vision and sort of quite a way sort of much further than the short-term mission of connecting the world's professionals. The question is, how does that vision manifest itself on a day-to-day basis? How many of you have heard about the social graph or heard the social graph referred to? A couple of hands. So I think it was originally Mark Zuckerberg who coined the phrase over at Facebook, the social graph. And it was about building a sort of a network of connections sort of within the social sphere. And within LinkedIn, we refer to something called the economic graph. And the economic graph, think about it as a digital map of the global economy. And the digital map of the global economy has six key pillars. So the first pillar is people. How do we ensure that all 3.2 billion people around the globe in the global workforce have a professional identity, have a profile of record? Second is ensuring that all of the companies have a presence on the platform as well, and that individuals know how they are connected to those companies up to 3 degrees. Third is ensuring that all of the jobs have a presence. So today, there's 7 million jobs on the platform. We believe there's approximately 20 million digitally available jobs around the globe today. So making sure that all of the jobs are available in those companies for all of those members. Next is the skills. What are the skills required in order to obtain those jobs in those companies? Next is higher education institutions. There's about 25,000 on LinkedIn today. So what are the higher education institutions that are required to train on the skills to get those jobs in those companies? And finally, and very importantly, it's about knowledge. It's about professionally relevant knowledge. Going back to the mission about connecting the world's professionals to make them more productive and more successful, the way that one can do that is through the distribution and consumption of professional knowledge. And so once you have all of these six key pillars, you have people, you have companies, you have jobs, you have skills, you have higher education institutions, and you have professionally relevant knowledge. Assuming all of that comes together over time, there is enormous value that can be extracted from it as a result. And I can share with you just a couple of examples of the way that we work with different partners today that are delivering value to our members and society more broadly. The first example is a piece of work that we did with the GMCA, so the Greater Manchester Combined Authority. We started this piece of work about a year and a half ago. It came to fruition in February when we announced the findings. And with the GMCA, we did a piece of work with them to understand, at the time, we had about 615,000 members in Greater Manchester. So who were the members on the platform in Greater Manchester, and what skills did they have? What were the jobs being advertised on the platform in Greater Manchester, and what skills were required in order to obtain those jobs? And then we could start identifying what the skills gap looked like between the people who were in Manchester and the jobs that were being advertised. And as a result of understanding what the skills gap looks like, you can then work with local universities, colleges, schools to start ensuring that we train on the skills for the future versus the skills of the past. Often with government data, there can be a 2 or 3 year lag when you start to see the results, but with LinkedIn's data, we can see it in real time. And there are 1 billion young people entering the workforce over the next decade, and only 40% of those jobs actually exist today. So there's a whole series of skills that we need to train on that either are just starting to exist or may not yet exist that will come to fruition over the coming years. That's one example. Another example is we work with an organization. Has anyone heard of Founders for Schools? No? Okay, so this is a great promotion for Founders for Schools. Founders for Schools is an organization that's set up to help teachers around the UK connect with business leaders. And the reason that it's important for teachers to connect with business leaders is there's a vast wave of research that shows that if students have an engagement with a business leader, so 4 engagements with business leaders, it means they're 5 times less likely to become NEET, so not in education, employment, or training. 4 engagements with the business leaders of private sector. An engagement can simply be a business leader walking into that school, sharing their experience, and they're 5 times less likely to become NEET, and their salary on average is 18% above the average. So huge value in being able to connect students or teachers with students. With business leaders. And traditionally, that's been very difficult for schools to do, but Founders for Schools have built a platform using LinkedIn's data set, which enables teachers to very quickly identify business leaders in the local community that they can send a note to and ask if they're willing to come in, share their experiences, share their advice with the students in that school. So a relatively frictionless way of connecting teachers with business leaders, which drives immense value for students who are sort of working their way through school. So that's a sort of very high-level view of LinkedIn's mission, our vision, how that manifests through what we refer to as the economic graph, as well as a couple of examples of how people are using the platform and using the data today. I was going to share more about our culture and values, but I will talk to that in more detail, I think, as part of the discussion that we're going to have.
Well, thank you for the introduction. I have just a few questions that I want to ask, and then we'll open it up to the whole of the audience. And I'd like to start with the whole sort of area of recruitment and selection, where I have a sense that social media, and LinkedIn in particular, is changing the whole way that recruitment and selection is done, and in the future will be done. And, you know, will we get to the stage where things like recruitment agencies and advertisements in newspapers and interviews are a thing of the past, and the way that people connect with their future employers is all done through social media, through LinkedIn? Would you just like to share some ideas about that?
Sure. So out of interest, how many people in here are involved in the recruitment space?
Now that's actually a relatively small number. I could imagine with many HR audiences, you would find a greater number of people. Perhaps we have 1 or 2 shy people in our audience.
So about 4 or 5 hands. And out of interest, from those people, how many use LinkedIn to aid with the recruitment? I love the fact there were more hands the second time than the first time. So there were definitely a couple of shy folk in the corner. In many respects, LinkedIn has helped revolutionize the sort of talent acquisition space. If you sort of wind the clock back 30, 40, 50 years, how did people used to recruit? People would put an ad in the store window or put an ad in the newspaper, and they would hopefully attract a large enough quantity of candidates of a high enough caliber that they could sort of pinpoint the ideal person to come and work at that business or organization. Today, I would argue that the majority of candidates are not active. And when I say active, they're not people who are putting up their hand and saying, I want to apply for that specific job. 70 to 80% of people today are passive candidates. And in many respects, passive candidates can be the best people. They're the people who are really happy in their current job. They're the people who are enjoying it, who are overperforming in their current role. And if you can tap into that, you can start attracting brilliant people. And so the way that sort of LinkedIn works today is it's a tool that gives people access to a database of talent, 467 million professionals, and allows me to pinpoint exactly the right group of people based on a certain set of criteria. And therefore, my pool is much larger, and I'm not necessarily restricted to the people who are looking at that ad domestically. I have the opportunity to broaden the scope and look truly sort of on an international basis for the very best talent. So going back to your question, LinkedIn's tools today, LinkedIn's recruiter tools, are used not just by in-house sort of HR and recruitment talent acquisition teams, but used extensively by the agency communities as well, recruitment agencies. And one could argue that sort of 4, 5, 6 years ago, as with any new technology, there was perhaps a degree of hesitancy or anxiety from the recruitment agency space. It's now one of our fastest growing businesses. The recruitment agencies have embraced LinkedIn's tools, and they're finding a whole assortment of other ways to demonstrate value to their clients. It's no longer just about the database of candidates that you have. It's about the experience that the candidate goes through, the relationship that you've built up with them. Another sort of fast-growing part of our business is employer branding. We were speaking about it sort of briefly before, and recruitment agencies are starting to get much more deeply involved in employer branding as well as straight talent acquisition. So I don't think that computers are going to take over. I think there will always be people who are there to meet candidates, to interview candidates. I hope that technology has reduced some of the friction in that process, but I don't for any means think it will eliminate the need to have highly qualified people, because ultimately when you take a bet on a candidate, and that's really what you do, you take a bet on a candidate, maybe an informed bet, but it's still a bet nonetheless, you need humans on one side of the table and humans on the other.
Yeah, okay. One of the other things we talked about earlier was how LinkedIn is now becoming a publishing business, and I was very interested in what you had to say about that.
So publishing, out of interest, I should have asked this at the beginning. Who's on LinkedIn? I'm now looking for the couple of, see if there's any sort of hands that are not up in the air. I'm assuming most people are on LinkedIn. How many of you have published on LinkedIn?
Quite a lot.
Cheating here. There's a couple of LinkedIn folks, so those sort of hands were up as well. Once again, how many of you have published on LinkedIn? Okay. If you don't, I won't pick on anybody, but if you don't mind sharing, sort of what have you published or what was your experience of publishing? Anyone willing to share?
There's one.
Thank you. So if we wind the clock back approximately 3 years ago, our product team was sort of brainstorming sort of future developments for the platform. And a couple of people thought to themselves, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if we had senior leaders, business leaders, luminaries, politicians using LinkedIn as a blogging platform, as an opportunity to publish long-form content? There were other platforms that allow you to publish short form, 140 characters, and there was a need in the professional sphere for people to have a opportunity to publish more long-form content. And so we started reaching out to a whole series of leaders, Richard Branson, Arianna Huffington, sort of President Obama, sort of various other sort of leaders around the globe. And amazingly and wonderfully, they sort of grabbed onto this and recognized that there was an amazing opportunity for them to build a relationship with 450 plus million professionals around the globe. And sort of as the weeks went on and the months went on, we started building up what we called our influencers, so the leading publishers on LinkedIn. And we built it to approximately 500 people. And it ended up to the degree where we were receiving incoming asks from CEOs of large global companies if they could become one of our publishers. And the benefit of publishing at the time was that you would publish from your profile and you would... our editorial team would put fuel behind the fire to ensure that the distribution spread perhaps more broadly than your immediate network. And we started seeing significant traction, significant engagement. We had really positive feedback from our members. And to your point, it wasn't about selling. It was about the question that we posed to them was, how do you deliver value back to professionals around the globe? Not just professionals, but keep in mind that your employees, your customers, your prospective customers, your future employees are all reading this content as well. And so how do you provide value back to that audience? So we set up certain themes on a monthly basis. What I would have, if I were 22 again, what would I have done differently? What are some of the best life lessons I've learned? And increasingly, we saw even more traction. And not only did we see more traction, but we had feedback from our members, which was, this is great, I love reading this content, but I'd like to publish. You know, I have an opinion, I have thoughts that I'd like to share with my network. And so we started opening up the publishing platform more broadly. And today, every single one of our 467 million members around the globe can now publish long-form content. And it is a initially daunting process to go through. I think I published my first piece of content maybe 18 months ago, sort of 2 years ago, and it was a post entitled "Why Coming Out is Great for Business." It's a very personal story. It was anxiety is probably an understatement in terms of what I felt as I was sort of hovering over the keyboard. And actually my HR business partner was standing next to me at then, and my finger was literally hovering above the keyboard, and she leant over and like sort of hit my fist. And she was like, it's done, it's gone. And what happens is you publish that piece of content, it sends a signal to everybody in your network, all of your first degree connections. They see a notification that you've published a piece of content, they can then read it, they can like it, they can take a sort of broad variety of social actions on it. And it was an amazing opportunity to share your own experiences. Again, not talk about your products and your services, but perhaps talk about the values of the company, sort of industry trends that you've seen, what your perspective is on industry trends. And we've seen some incredible stories around the globe, which happen on a sort of daily basis. I think there's I'll check the numbers. I think it's north of 200,000 or 300,000 sort of posts now on a weekly basis, around the globe. But there was a great example of Target, and Target in the US had a security breach, and rather than sort of the traditional path that you would go down, you would ask your comms team what to do, what the messaging looks like to the press. Their CMO, who had a profile on LinkedIn, published a long-form piece of content, put his hand up and said, we're really sorry, we made a mistake, we recognize the mistake, and this is what we're going to do to rectify it. And it was a very open, honest, transparent narrative which went viral very quickly and alleviated some of the concern that their internal comms team had, because they demonstrated such transparency. And I'm a great believer, we can touch on it separately, but I'm a great believer in sort of transparency within organizations. Another example, the New York Times wrote a piece maybe a year or so ago about the culture of working at Amazon at the time. And it was a pretty damning piece. And one of the Amazon employees took to LinkedIn and wrote a counter-argument about what it was really like to work at Amazon and how they loved it there and they loved the culture and the innovation that came through. And I think to date that's had north of a million views and went viral and sort of went through the news networks and was in all the newspapers as well. And again, it was just a very honest, open, sort of transparent piece that came from their heart, that talked to the culture, the values of the organization, and gave them direct access to an audience of 450 million professionals around the globe. And so for those of you, by the way, that haven't published, I strongly encourage you to jump on board. It's like diving into freezing water on the first pass, but it gets better over time.
Yeah, good, thank you. You talked a bit about the economic graph earlier, and I'd just like to ask you a bit more about that. So I now, when I first heard about it, I was intrigued and slightly puzzled. So now I understand graph as in graph theory, as in networks, so I can see that part of it. And I can see economic in terms of the actors or the, I don't know, the nodes that you're talking about connecting. I'm interested in what, you know, what's the vision? How's LinkedIn going to generate revenues through the economic graph? And how are other people going to benefit from their involvement in it?
Sure. So I can touch on that in two ways. So one is how LinkedIn generates money today. And then secondly, the benefits that accrue to sort of our members, companies, as a result of the economic graph. Do you mind if I steal the water at the same time? Thank you very much. So in terms of how LinkedIn sort of monetizes the platform today, we make money in maybe six different ways, some more material than others. So first and foremost, what we refer to as our talent solutions business. Our talent business is, depending on the quarter, approximately 60% of our revenue. And that is recruiters, HR professionals, staffing agencies being able to access LinkedIn's tools, a piece of software to access the database so they can find the very best talent in the world. They also buy things like job slots on LinkedIn. There's 7 million jobs on there today, so they pay to feature and sort of promote jobs. The second part of that business is employer branding. So increasingly we're seeing the executive team and in the boardroom are coming together of HR and marketing, recognizing that you can no longer have a different message to different sort of audiences. Your message that's going to your investors is now the same message that's going to your customers and your future customers and your employees. Just by nature of the internet and social, it's very difficult to have discrete messages to various different audiences, considering that in many cases they are one and the same. So that's our talent business. Our marketing solutions business, which is our advertising business, that is a business that helps primarily B2B brands or high-end B2C brands like Cartier, or if somebody's selling business seats on British Airways or Virgin Atlantic, helps those customers, those brands, build a relationship and engage with all of our members around the globe. And the primary way that that happens today is through the distribution of sponsored content in the newsfeed. So for those of you who access LinkedIn on mobile, you'll know that the primary user interface is the feed. Likewise on desktop, it's the first thing that you see. And every now and then you will see sponsored content in the newsfeed. And again, sort of when we're speaking to our customers, we say to them, look, it's not just about promoting your products and services. How can you as an organization be helpful to your customers or your prospective customers? What content can you share that's going to aid in their productivity? And we believe that that, therefore, reflects positively on the brand. And that's about 20% of our business. The remaining 20% is a combination of different business lines. So firstly is premium subscriptions. LinkedIn is built for the free member, and there are a number of people who subscribe and have additional functionality, so that's premium subscriptions. Lots of small businesses, sales development professionals, people who are very actively looking for jobs. The next part of that business is a business line that we call Sales Solutions. The product is called Sales Navigator, and it is a tool that helps sales professionals and business development professionals be more successful and be more productive. At its core, we don't believe that cold calling people is an effective way to do business. And this originally started, there was somebody in the office, I think they'd been going to pitch a large technology company. They came back into the office, they hadn't won that piece of business. They were a little sort of frustrated. And somebody about six or seven seats down the corridor put up their hand and said, "Why didn't you tell me? I used to go to school with the CMO over there, I know the CEO very well, I could have made an introduction." And again, we don't believe cold calls is an effective way to do business. If you can facilitate a warm introduction, if you can benefit from your network, that is going to set you up for greater success than if you're just sort of cold calling somebody. So that's Sales Navigator. And the two other businesses, one is called LinkedIn Learning. So we acquired a company called Lynda approximately 2 years ago. And Lynda was one of the largest online repositories of high-quality learning videos around the globe. There's about 9,000 of them on the platform today. And through those videos, you can learn financial acumen, you can read a P&L, you can do presentation training, you can go and learn about PowerPoint and Microsoft Word. And that is, if you're a premium subscriber to LinkedIn, you can now access all of those 9,000 long-form videos. As well as companies subscribing on behalf of their employees, so all of their employees have access for continuous on-the-job learning. And finally, a business which is fastly emerging called Elevate, which is about employee advocacy. We firmly believe that your employees are not only your most vocal, but often your most powerful brand advocates. And today, many marketers don't necessarily think of their employees as a channel to promote goods, services, culture, values of the organization. We disagree. We believe they're an incredibly effective way. In fact, based on our research, people trust content that comes from your employees more so than they trust content that comes directly from your company. You know, one could argue there's a breakdown in trust more broadly in society, and I think that's one of the ways that it manifests. And so this is a really simple, easy way for your employees to source content which is curated or created by your organization and seamlessly distributed out through your respective social sphere, so Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, etc. So that's the way that we make money today. In terms of the value for those different groups, so if I'm a member, the value for me is that I can build a network. The larger the number of people on LinkedIn, the more beneficial it is for me. I can connect with opportunity, and that could be finding a new customer. It could be finding a new job. It could be finding an employee for a small business. For companies, we help them hire, market, sell. The larger, the deeper the network, the more robust the network, the more beneficial it is for them. And for employees of an organization, there's an opportunity for them to build their professional brand through the publishing platform and through their main LinkedIn profile.
Yeah, very interesting. We might talk a bit more about that later. So you provide a vehicle that's spans boundaries and borders. And of course, boundaries and borders are becoming very topical these days with Brexit and all of that. And I just wondered if you had any specific thoughts about the implications of Brexit for business generally and, you know, for social media, what implications social media Brexit might have for social media.
Sure. So we've been, not surprisingly, thinking a lot about this recently. And we actually did some research. Excuse me, apologies. We did some research just in the build-up to the referendum. And the results came back, I guess in hindsight weren't that surprising, but at the time slightly surprised us, which was that 53% of our members didn't understand the implications on their career if they voted leave or remain. That's a significant number. And so our first port of call was, how do we help our membership in the UK make the most informed decision? And so actually through the publishing platform, we sourced a number of leaders in the space to publish both for and against, to share whatever their perspective was, and to help our members make a more informed decision. It ended up being that we had 11,500 long-form posts all about how Brexit may benefit or not benefit you and your career and your company. And so first step was, how do we help our members become the most informed they can be about the decision that they're making? Since the referendum, we also wanted to understand the pulse of organisations, but also use our data to help our companies and policymakers make the most informed decisions. So we did a piece of research that showed over the last 3 years, 40% of professional migration into the UK has come from the EU27, 17% from the US and 14% from Asia. And when you look at the 40% that came in professional migration from the EU, that group is twice as likely to have a master's or doctorate as the average LinkedIn member in the UK. And there were certain industries that were more exposed because there were a higher percentage of those industries that relied on professional migration from the EU. So professional services, insurance, financial services, and technology. And with this data, we therefore were able to have conversations with our customers about how they should be thinking about strategic workforce planning over the next 2 to 3 years. Questions that you should be asking yourself. So where's your talent coming from? We were briefly discussing it before. I think in many instances, people have a gut feeling where their talent is coming from and where it's going to. But often when we work with chief execs and HR leaders and they see the actual data, they are always, or 99% of the time, they're surprised. We can show you which companies your talent is going to, which companies you are drawing talent in from, which skills are leaving your organization, which skills are coming in, which countries people are coming from, which countries are people going to. And so amazing information, and it's important for people to have an understanding of that as they do their workforce planning. The second question is, how well is your employer brand known both domestically and internationally? We're working with a technology customer at the moment in the UK, and they're looking to hire a large number of sales professionals over the next 6 months. But when we looked at our data, they've only engaged with less than 1% of all the sales professionals which are in the cities where they're looking to hire talent from. And there's a myth there. You know, people don't know their brand. So in exactly the same sort of way as we think about marketing, you drive up a funnel brand awareness and eventually you pull somebody down the funnel until you convert, have a conversion. It's exactly the same with talent. You need to drive awareness. People need to be aware of your values. In fact, we did some research recently that showed that north of 50% of candidates would discount working for a company if they didn't have visibility into the values and the culture of that organization. And therefore, as a company, it's incredibly important that you brand yourselves effectively, and that when your recruiters or the search agency is sending an email request or an email request to a potential candidate, they're not being cold called, because that candidate already knows what it's like to work at the organization because they've already been exposed to that messaging. And so that's some of the data that we pulled around Brexit. The other piece that we released last week was an analysis since the referendum to understand whether companies were pulling back in some areas and whether they were investing in other areas. And what we noticed was that companies were pulling back. They were specifically pulling back in administrative and support roles. There'd been a 4% decline since the referendum. Conversely, there'd been a 4% increase in sales development and business roles, so roles which directly correlate to revenue and drive the bottom line. There were certain industries that, again, sort of where we'd seen those trends, so oil and energy, gas, I think media and one other. I'll check the specific industries. But industries that were potentially sort of had seen greater turmoil perhaps over the last 6 to 9 months. We also, by the way, saw a 7% rise in entrepreneurship. And that's perhaps sort of recognizing this transition of people into the gig economy, but also a broader trend that we've seen whereby people from large enterprises more and more so are wanting to move to work in small businesses. We've seen that shift over the last 12 months where people have a greater sense of flexibility, autonomy, and they want perhaps a greater sense of purpose. And so we've continued to see this shift, and I think that presented in the data, the 7% rise in entrepreneurship, much of that was people working in companies of less than 10 people. So that's some of the benefit of having the economic graph, and that data set means that you can start to extract information that helps individuals, companies, and policymakers make the most informed decisions based on real-time data.
Yeah, good, thank you. Two more questions from me. Now, my wife sent me a text earlier in the week, and she asked me what I knew about kindliness. Now, I wondered if this was a subtle message that I had not emptied the dishwasher or put the bins out or something else. Anyway, when I clarified it with her, she said, no, she was talking about kindliness in management, and she referred me, saying, you are a management academic, perhaps you could read this book about kindliness in management. Now, I think you're interested in a related concept, compassion in management, and I just wondered if you'd like to talk a little bit about that.
Sure. How many of you have been exposed to or read about compassionate management? Compassionate management. Apologies, my throat is going. Okay, a couple of people. So it's relatively straightforward. It's about the idea of can you walk a mile in the person's shoes with whom you're speaking within a work environment? And there's a sort of sometimes sort of people, I think people conflate empathy and compassion, and the best way to describe it is that if you were walking up a mountain and there was somebody that was stuck under a rock, if you were empathetic, you would put yourself in their shoes, but you would physically feel the pain, and that pain would potentially prohibit you from taking any action. If you demonstrate compassion, you can still put yourself in their shoes, but slightly objectively, to try and understand how they're feeling, and therefore you would move the rock out of the way and help them on their way. And exactly the same within a work environment. How can you, when you're speaking to your team, your colleagues, in fact, customers as well, sort of heighten your emotional intelligence and put yourself in their shoes to understand what their perspective is? And I think in some instances, people can confuse compassion with lack of action or being sort of too nice, per se. But actually, often if you're doing the compassionate thing, you may not leave somebody in their seat for too long. If there's somebody who is potentially underperforming, and if you put yourself in their shoes, that person doesn't want to be underperforming. Perhaps they're in the wrong role, perhaps they're in the wrong company. And if you do the compassionate thing, you can either sort of help them sort of develop their skills to very quickly get back on track, or help them move to another role or another organization. So I think compassion can work in a number of different ways, but for me it's an incredibly important philosophy for how I manage, for how we manage or try to manage at LinkedIn. And is often overlooked, I think, when it comes to a bit kindliness, sort of empathy, compassion is often overlooked in the workplace. And being able to walk a mile in the person's shoes to whom you're speaking is beneficial for client meetings, it's beneficial for one-on-ones. We have this sort of very interesting induction process at LinkedIn. So the first 2 days, go to our headquarters in Dublin, you have a 2-day induction. And one of the first people that you meet is our head of HR. And sort of Wendy, who leads HR, comes into the meeting, and the first thing she says is, guys, like, we know you're going to leave one day. And we know you're going to leave because we have amazing data that shows that people leave companies. So don't for a minute think that we don't think at some point you're going to leave the business. And so how do we make your experience whilst you're at LinkedIn the best it can possibly be, and have a very transparent conversation around your role, how long it's going to last, and what you want to do next? Reid Hoffman, our founder, co-wrote a book called The Alliance. And the analogy was sort of with the army and the tour of duty. And so when someone comes into the business, you can say to them, are you, like, so this is the role I want you to do. This is the role we need you as a business to do. I think that role or that task is perhaps going to take 2 years, maybe 3 years. And that person in response is like, great, sounds good. These are the skills I'd like to develop when I'm in your business. So it's like, great, we can help you develop those skills. By the way, do you have any idea or visibility on what you want to do after that? If it's yes, great, we can help you develop the skills for the role that you may take after that. And that role that you do after may be at LinkedIn or it could be elsewhere. I had a conversation with somebody the other day in my team who has been at the business for a while, in the business for a while, and we were talking about the next 18 months. And they said to me, look, I think I've got a good 6 to 12 months in the current role, and these are the types of things I'm thinking of doing next. And then we had a very open discussion about whether those types of things, whether we would have roles in the UK business for the types of things that this individual wanted to do next. And both of us sort of came to the realization relatively quickly that there may be, but there's also, there's a significant likelihood that the skills they want to develop would be in organizations outside of LinkedIn. And so the conversation we had was, great, like, what are the types of companies that you want to work in? You know, we're a pretty connected organization, and therefore, can we help make introductions to any of those third-party organizations so that you can start having conversations now in preparation for maybe taking those roles in 12 months' time? Not only that, but what are the skills that you need in order to obtain those roles, and do you have them today? And if there's a gap, how can we help develop those skills over the next 12 months? And that transparency, that tour of duty discussion, that sort of concept of compassionate management, I think leads to a much more healthy working relationship and also drives productivity, because there's nothing worse than somebody coming to you and saying, oh, I've just got another job, I'm heading out the door in 2, 3, 4 weeks' time. The idea from a company perspective to know sort of where your talent is today and where it will go in the future and to be able to pipeline effectively and also help that person on their way. We always say, you know, when you come into LinkedIn, we want to give you the very best experience. At the same time, obviously, you need to deliver for the company. So it's a two-way agreement. It's like a virtual agreement that we sign. But I firmly believe that that is a healthy way to run an organization, at least from the experiences that we've had.
Josh, last question from me. Diversity, inclusion, and belonging, maybe a sort of a development of what we've just been talking about, but I know you have strong views about those things as well, and I wondered if you'd like to share some of those with us.
Sure. So the sad fact is there's about $4 billion spent on diversity and inclusion programs around the world, and the majority of them fail. And they fail for a whole plethora of reasons: lack of commitment, too much focus on the outputs versus the inputs, no quantification of the business impact of diversity and inclusion. And of course we need to fix that. And we firmly believe in diversity, inclusion, belonging, and I'll touch on belonging in a moment, because very candidly, we want to win. Like, we believe that diverse inclusion belonging is good for business. It's good for our people. It's good for business. It helps us be more productive. And I'm sure everybody's seen the data about companies being X times more profitable as a result of embracing diversity and having diverse working groups. This sense of belonging is relatively new. And you know, we all want a sense of belonging. If you think about the time you spend with your family, with your friends, with your work colleagues, there's a whole piece of research recently in neuroscience that shows the same neural networks that you use for your primary needs, such as food and water, the same neural networks are used for social needs, and that having a sense of attachment and belonging to a series of co-workers can be an even more powerful motivator than money. And so the facts are pretty indisputable. The question is, like, how do you embrace that? And I, at the age of 22, came out to my parents. It was a wonderfully awkward Friday night. But at the age of 22, I came out to my parents, and that Monday morning, like 62% of Gen Y grads today went straight back into the closet. And by the way, 62% of grads who are out go back into the closet when they start in the workplace. It is crazy, crazy depressing statistics. And it took me quite a few years to be comfortable bringing my authentic self into work every day. And when I started on that journey, and it certainly was a journey, there were all these amazing benefits that started sort of coming to me. I was able to build more trusting relationships with our clients, with colleagues, with sort of people on the team. Hopefully it heightened my sense of emotional intelligence. Others would sort of, I think that, but others may disagree. It made work a hell of a lot more fun. And it made me more productive. There's a load of data that shows you spend what they refer to as covering. You spend about 30% of your time avoiding certain conversations, avoiding certain colleagues. Like it's miserable. It's depressing. And when you have that amazing sense of freedom, it drives your productivity and is a far better place to work. And I believe not only drove my productivity, but drove the productivity of the organization for which I was working for at the time. And sort of that was really the root, the foundation of my belief in embracing diversity, inclusion, and belonging. And so at LinkedIn, we have embraced that. We have 8 employee resource groups of various different ages operating in 27 countries. We've got 25% of our employees around the globe who are engaged in those ERGs. We are one of the few companies who are very transparent, wherever we can be, on our data around gender, we have a group called BIG, which is a sort of black and inclusion group, and around disability. And we firmly believe that the more transparent one can become, the more rapidly you can drive change. And so, yeah, sorry, long-winded way of answering your question, but I firmly believe in it. I believe that it is good for business.
Good, thank you. Well, I've enjoyed our conversation. I'm now going to have to be unselfish and open it up to the audience. So if you want to ask a question, could I ask you to wave at me or something like that? And could I then ask you just to wait until you have a microphone before you ask the question so that everybody can hear and you can be on record. So, gentlemen at the back.
Hi, Josh. My name is David Randall. So, apropos of your case study about Greater Manchester, if in our little group we've got a tech cluster going in southwest London, if we wanted to do some sort of talent, skills gap analysis or talent transfer analysis ourselves, how would we go about doing that? Would we have to go to through you, or are there tools available that we can already use, or how would that work?
So the majority of those, sorry guys, on the good end of a bad cold, so in the majority of instances, they are a series of proprietary tools, notably around talent flows and skills migration. Some of it we're starting to build through APIs, so third parties can access it or will begin to access it. But in general, they're proprietary tools that require our insights analysts to mine LinkedIn's data set. So you would have to come through the LinkedIn team in order to be able to access that type of data.
Yeah, there's a gentleman here.
Hi, Rudy Parker, Center Scaler. First of all, just want to say I don't work for LinkedIn, but I'm quite an evangelist. So I first got into LinkedIn. I was living over in the States. My wife worked for McKinsey. She was a recruiter for McKinsey. So I got into it in about 2006, and now I find it absolutely invaluable. I work in marketing, and even just recently, I'm looking for a job and connected with a really senior executive at Adobe. Don't know him, but through LSE. And an amazing opportunity came up, and I wouldn't have even known about that. So it's a great tool. But I just wanted to mention, so you mentioned like Sales Navigator, and so I work in software, marketing and software, and there's this very trendy new term, account-based marketing.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if you, because I just see a lot of, you know, I've been using all the tools for a long time, like the Sales Navigator, but I see that as a real opportunity in marketing. You know, we're looking for enterprise companies and really senior people, and I've managed to build really good lists in that area, and just wondered if that was something you explored.
So. Absolutely. So account-based marketing is something that both our clients do, and LinkedIn as a marketer have embraced very significantly over the last couple of years. And at its core, it's about identifying specific cohorts of companies, certain individuals within those companies, and having very focused programs about how one nurtures those prospects over time. And you can nurture them through technology, you can nurture them through in-person activities as well. You can upload contact lists into LinkedIn and retarget them on the LinkedIn platform. You can serve sponsored content through to those specific groups as well. The term has perhaps been used more frequently over the last 12 to 18 months, but I would argue that people have been doing versions of account-based marketing, you know, for as long as people have been marketing. It's similar, in my view, to the term content marketing. So content marketing has been embraced more so over the last 3 or 4 years, specifically with the advent of mobile devices and feed-based engagement on social platforms. But there were tire companies 100 years ago who were producing brochures for drivers on the streets of Paris, and they would argue that was content marketing at the time. So technology, of course, has helped enormously to make this a more precise art, and perhaps combined art with science to make it more effective. But account-based marketing is certainly something that we embrace and that increasingly our clients are as well.
Let's take the lady at the back, if we could, and then we'll come to the gentleman at the front.
Hi, Josh. Susan Barnes here. So I just wanted to know how LinkedIn built their reputation to ensure credibility of the candidates on their site. Because a lot of times you can get listing skills and you just have people you know from university saying, yes, I'll endorse that skill. So how did they go ahead and build that when it was first starting?
The platform in general or specific skills? The
platform in general.
The platform in general. So I think the nature of the environment is critical. And within LinkedIn, you work in a professional environment, a professional context. We did some research a few years ago that showed 80% of our members want to keep their personal and professional lives separate to one another. And there's a phrase that we use in the office, which is, you don't want your Saturday night to meet your Monday morning. And as a result, we have been very fortunate that individuals, as they're building their professional identity, are very thoughtful about what they publish, what they post, what they share. And in many respects, the network is self-policing. So if I claim to be the CEO of LinkedIn, not only will Jeff, our CEO, call me out on it, but there's another 9,500 people in our company that will call me out on it. And therefore, people are very cautious is probably too extreme, but I think twice about what I post and what I like and what I share because it reflects on my professional identity. And I think as a result of that, we've been fortunate that we have incredibly accurate data, which I know is going to benefit me because it helps potential companies and recruiters identify me as talent to potentially go and work there in the future. And the reputation has remained as a result of it being a professional platform. I don't think we've ever had a specific focus on how do we sort of maintain our reputation, we've focused on the core, which is about how do we connect professionals, how do we deliver them value, how do we make them productive, how do we make them successful. And as a result of focusing and having a core set of values and a core vision and a core mission, the reputation has developed around that. In the early days, as with any startup, it's a relatively lean team. And as I said, I joined in 2011, started in 2003, and I joined in 2011, and we were only 800 people. So we didn't have, at the time, brand marketing teams, people who were looking at public policy, broader reputational issues. And we were very fortunate that as a result of the professional network and the value that it was creating to our members, people maintained a strong sense of community and sort of didn't start posting stuff which was irrelevant or inappropriate.
I think the gentleman here is next.
Hello, Joseph. I'm a grad student at LSE. I've read that Facebook is going to unleash a new possibility for companies to, you know, add some job listing in their Facebook pages, considering the fact that LinkedIn now they have like 467 million users and Facebook 1.8 billion users. And considering, again, the fact that most of the time people use it for personal purpose, but even though I have two Facebook accounts, one professional and one personal one, do you think that this gonna impact or treat LinkedIn business or not at all?
So
also, like I read that in this article that people will be able to put, like, to complete their profile by putting their skills, competencies, as we can do it already on LinkedIn. So like this, I don't know if it's going to really like be a threat for LinkedIn.
So unfortunately, I can't comment on sort of the strategy of other platforms in the marketplace. At LinkedIn, we've been doing what we've been doing since 2003, and every day we invest in products and engineering and the platform to be able to provide value for our members and our companies. You know, 7 million jobs on there today, 21 million people in the UK, it's about 62% of the working population in the UK, and we're just very much focused on the job that we have at hand. So we try not to spend too much time thinking about what other people in the marketplace are doing.
So, lady, third row back, wasn't it? Yeah, you, that's it, the next person.
Hi, fellow evangelist here. My name is Janelle. I'm in the Human Resources and Organizations Department. So you were talking about Reid Hoffman before. He also wrote The Startup of You, where he introduces the concept of being in permanent beta. So I know maybe a lot of us in this room are career changers or taking time away from work to focus on this education at LSE. So how can we successfully market ourselves on LinkedIn through that lens and keeping the concept of permanent beta in mind?
Absolutely. It's really interesting because there are large groups of society that have materially changed the way they sort of think about employment today. So there was a load of stats recently that showed if you're under 30, you'll generally have about 4 employers sort of by the time you're 30. If you go back to the 1970s, I think the average employee had 2 employers in their lifetime. Today, Generation Y have about 13. So sort of the shape of the workforce is changing. And the idea of having a job for life no longer or very rarely exists in today's world. And therefore, there are a large number of people like you who will take time out to study, to travel, to have new experiences, perhaps to try another sort of area that perhaps isn't core to their training and their background. And for everybody, whether you're in a job, whether you're in sort of beta mode, whether you're in education, you can still develop your professional identity. You have this wonderful platform that enables you to build a community, to build a network, to publish your ideas, to publish your thoughts, you know, think about what you're learning, think about the experiences that you've had that you can share with those around you. All of that continues to build on your professional brand and reflects well on you when you do go into a future employer to have an interview. So I don't necessarily think there's a difference between the way you build your professional brand if you're in a job or if you're sort of taking a break for education. You still have the opportunity to showcase your experiences, your skills from your previous employers. And also when you think about, I'll give you an example. Say, we work very closely with the East London Business Alliance, and there are a group of people that came into the office to talk about their LinkedIn profiles, and they generally had LinkedIn profiles, but they weren't necessarily built out. And there was a lady I was talking to who started the conversation by saying, I'm not sure I've got anything to share on my profile. I was like, you must, everybody has something to share on their profile. So I spent about 20 minutes talking to her, and what I discovered is that she's set up two beauty salons in her spare time, employed 10 staff, had two profitable businesses, and was looking for something else to do. And I'm like, this is amazing. And so it's, she was incredibly impressive, and it was about how we helped her translate her experiences into stories that she could put on her profile. And by the time we finished, she had this amazingly robust profile that, frankly, any employer in their right mind would have been crazy not to interview her. But often we struggle with how to identify the skills or the experiences or the wins that we've had in the past and sort of to position them in the public domain. And frankly, I don't know how many people are from the UK in here, but there's this traditional sort of British reserve where we're almost embarrassed to talk about our strengths. We've been brought up to say, you know, it's good to be shy in some respects. You shouldn't think about showing off in the public domain. And actually, this is an area where, yes, you should. You should think about how you can showcase your best self. This is your professional brand, and I think collectively we need to become more comfortable at being confident about our accomplishments and putting them out in the public domain, because ultimately that's going to generate a whole load of goodness further down the line for each of us.
Good. That lady, yeah?
Hi. First of all, thank you so much for today's session. It was really great. I have a slightly technical question from an applicant's perspective. So when you go and probably search for a job, and you click on it, so there's an apply button right there. I just wanted to ask, when you see the data that's given below, which says how many people have actually applied for the job, and then there's like how many people have a master's degree or a bachelor's degree, and there's a whole analysis. I just wanted to ask, like, just by clicking on that, that number is generated, or there's another way of like sort of getting that number? Like, from an applicant perspective, I would rather want to know that what's my competition like. So.
And so today, you go to that page, you can see the role. Once you click on the role, it showcases that data underneath?
No, I just, before I even click on it, if I just go below and see what the competition is like, so there's a number that's generated.
Yeah.
My question is, if, for example, if I click on it and I actually go to the relevant employer page and I don't land up applying for the job, does it still get calculated as an applicant? Because for me it's important, because I've seen sometimes there are some jobs where it just shows a very enormous number, and that's sort of intimidating as well to see, oh my God, there's so many applicants in the past like just 5 days, and to see, like, because there's a whole analysis that LinkedIn actually generates right there.
Yeah.
That how many have a master's degree and whatever, like.
So I will triple check for you. My understanding is that data is based on the applicants themselves. It's not just based on people clicking to learn more information about the role. And when you're on LinkedIn, when you click the button, there is a way to submit your application directly from LinkedIn. And when you submit it and it goes through to the CRM system of the of either the search agency or the employer, that's when that data set changes and updates.
I think there was someone down the front. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi, Josh. Hi. Valeria Mille. I'm an addict, a LinkedIn addict. I confess that. I recently changed my profile, my career, going from corporate working for myself, so I'm leveraging LinkedIn big time, and therefore I developed an addiction. Yes. My question is, you covered how LinkedIn actually was influencing the recruitment in the past and is still doing. You also mentioned the blog and the whole coming out in terms of posting your ideas and your opinion. What do you think is going to be the future? Like, if you can share with us any trends in the sphere of employment, of business, and especially in light of potentially Microsoft getting in the picture. What's your best view, your best guess of how
looking
it will
into the
be
crystal
like?
Ball. So on Microsoft, unfortunately, I can't go into detail on that. All I can say is that, you know, we, subject to some regulatory approvals, we continue to hope that it will close between now and the end of the year. But you know, the beauty of Microsoft is that we have wonderful alignment on visions. They look to empower people, empower businesses, and creating economic opportunity for the workforce. There's a sort of wonderful sort of coming together there of the two organizations. In terms of future trends, so it depends in which area of our business we're thinking about. We are continuing, as I mentioned before, we're continuing to see this shift of, notably, I hate the word millennial, so apologies for using it, because I think it sort of encapsulates so many different groups who are so distinct in so many ways, but I will generalize and say millennials just for the purposes of this. We are seeing this sort of shift, as I mentioned, from large enterprises to SMEs. That's a pretty significant shift that we're seeing over the last 18 to 24 months. The data that I mentioned earlier about the 7% rise in entrepreneurship, that tallies with everything that we're seeing. We're seeing this shift towards the gig economy. You're seeing the likes of Uber, the likes of Deliveroo, Airbnb, sort of people sort of starting to have wanting a greater sense of autonomy, flexibility. To the lady who was talking before about sort of moving into sort of education for a certain period of time. People want sort of these two lives to some degree. I was checking into a hotel last week, and the gentleman that was checking me in, sort of, I gave him my email address, and he was like, oh, I'm using LinkedIn all the time. And this was his temporary role, and on the side, he was setting up two businesses, and he was like, was very active on LinkedIn in terms of setting up these two businesses, finding new business, finding people to come and work for the company, raising money. And those are the stories that we're seeing day in, day out, more frequently today than ever before. And it's strange to some degree, because you think with a degree of macroeconomic uncertainty that people would revert back to large companies, stability, comfort, sort of roles for a long period of time. And that's not actually, it's the opposite that we've been seeing for the last 18 months. So that's one of the trends that we're seeing when it comes to talent. This idea of employer branding, which 3-5 years ago, if you went to speak to most people, except for the very advanced players in the space, 3-5 years ago, most people would not competently talk about employer branding as a key initiative for an HR and a marketing organization. And there is so much competition in the space, specifically in the STEM space today, that companies are competing. There is a war on for talent, for highly skilled talent. You know, the skills gap in the UK is increasing at 7% over the last couple of years. People are fighting for people in the STEM space, and therefore they're increasingly needing to differentiate themselves from the competitive set. And the way that they're doing that is they are being very vocal about what they stand for, their brand values, their purpose, as well as the, you know, compensation benefits, you know, the cultural experience of what it's like to go and work in a specific organization. But that is quite a significant shift that we've seen over the last few years. And this merging of HR and marketing, and lots of marketing professionals being employed by HR teams, and lots of HR professionals being employed by marketing teams, is certainly something we didn't see 7 to 10 years ago when we were starting to monetize the site.
So perhaps just a couple more questions. So lady at the back and lady at the back.
Hi, Josh. Hi. It's Rachel Miller here. So you spoke
about... I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Rachel.
Thanks.
So you spoke about the importance of diversity and inclusion. So I just wanted to know your views or what you know about how LinkedIn has increased diversity through being a tool for recruitment, and in particular social mobility, so where people might not have those connections and networks through their family or their social connections. So I'd be interested in your views and thoughts on that.
Sure. So I'll try and break that down into two separate parts, the latter first. One of the sort of founding principles of LinkedIn, when Reid and his co-founders were brainstorming what the future of work would look like, was that the network in itself could help democratize access to opportunity, and therefore the idea of only being able to secure a role through nepotism went out the window, or went out the window to some degree. And the fact that you now have a platform by which you can connect to a CEO, and that CEO within a professional environment is highly likely to respond to you, means that you're not as reliant as perhaps one used to be on your family connections. And so, again, that's another reason why I love working there, because I love the idea of democratizing this access to opportunity. You know, I had a fortunate upbringing, but I also chose to drop out of university, and I thought that dropping out of university would sort of be detrimental to my career progression. And platforms like LinkedIn have meant that it is okay for people today to not have a linear sort of education and linear sort of employee path, and that you can do well, you can become a great professional, you can join great companies without that immediate network that perhaps families have given to certain fortunate individuals, and perhaps without the formal education that may have been expected 5 or 10 years ago. In fact, I remember joining LinkedIn, and the first thing that I saw was some of the job specs, because we were hiring a large number of people at the time, and all of them, there was an expectation or a specification that you needed a degree and ideally a master's. I was like, get rid of it. There's no way I can, in sort of good conscience, ask people to have higher education if they have all the sort of prerequisite skills that we need. Around diversity and inclusion, specifically when it comes to recruitment, so as with many others, we are on a journey. And there are a large number of programs that we run. So as an example, when people are applying for jobs at LinkedIn, as a hiring manager, we now train people where necessary to delay the process to ensure that you get a fair distribution. At the time, we were looking at gender between men and women, and we recognize that sometimes that can take a longer period of time, but we believe that the benefits over an extended period of time are worth the original investments. Likewise, when you come to LinkedIn and you meet the various different people on the interview process, perhaps 7 years ago you may have met 6 men. Today that's very different. We ensure that there is a sort of true diverse, not only candidate slate, but a sort of group of people who are participating in the interview process. We also, through each of our ERGs, Outed In, which is our LGBT group, BIG, which is our Black Inclusion group, GEMS, sort of Geo and Ethnic Minorities, through all of our ERGs, there are specific programs which include outreach to various different sectors of the community to ensure that we are fishing in a very diverse pool of candidates. We're also, as you can imagine, exploring what that looks like from a product perspective as well. But we are by no means perfect, but we are doing our best, and anybody who has any other advice that we can take, we would love to hear it.
So, Sapana, did you want to ask the last question?
Yeah. Hi, Josh. Thank you so much for your insightful talk and very frank responses to questions. So this is just going back to, I think, a previous point that you were making about skills gaps, and especially in the sort of tech space, but wider as well. I mean, there is a huge competition for talent, as you said. And I just wondered, given the emphasis that the government has placed, and actually employers are getting more and more kind of wired up to this as well, about apprenticeships, I just wondered, as one of the biggest sort of talent influencers, career influencers, does LinkedIn have a position on this? And is there anything that you're doing to work with the government, to work with the Department of Education, who I think are the current hosts of the SFA, and employers to, because I think apprenticeships does still carry some sort of stigma, especially for, I don't know, for parents. I work with tech companies myself. So it's, you know, I'm just interested to understand what your sort of thinking is about that.
Sure, so any investments in apprenticeships are, in our opinion, incredibly worthwhile. And so I would encourage, if people have the opportunity to do apprenticeships, absolutely. If companies are looking to bring them in, there are hundreds, thousands of examples of companies that have seen huge value from apprenticeships, and those people have either stayed and gone on to incredible roles or moved into the broader work environment and been incredibly successful as well, and helped them develop some of the core skills that they need. When it comes to skills development specifically, we certainly work with policymakers in the UK and sort of various other countries around the globe to help them identify what the skills gaps are in society, and therefore how we can help inform the education curriculum based on what's needed for tomorrow versus what was required yesterday. We also, through LinkedIn Learning, when people are applying for jobs on LinkedIn, we want to be able to get to a stage where, when you're applying for a job, no matter what level of applicant you may be, it may say, okay, these are the 10 skills that you need in order to be successful in this role. And I look at my profile and I realize I only have 7 of them. So can we then surface some of the videos that help you bridge the gap to acquire the 3 skills that perhaps you didn't have, again, to give you that sort of leg up, to give you that jump, to make you more likely to be successful in your application. And that is at the core of our acquisition of lynda.com. It's about bridging the skills gap, helping people be on a journey of continuous learning. We don't believe that learning is a one-time thing. It shouldn't just be, you know, you go to school or you go to university and then everything stops. There should be a continuous learning experience, whether you're out of a company or in a company, and most notably when you're in a company. And we hope that that assortment of 9,000 plus courses and growing by the day can go some way to helping bridge that skills gap.
Good. Well, ladies and gentlemen, a core competence of a good chairman is to bring things to an end on time. So I'm going to draw the formal part of proceedings to a close now. I'd like to thank you all for coming. I'd like to thank Cohesion again for sponsoring the event and particularly for allowing some of our students to come here without paying. Please look out for future events of the HRM alumni group. But most of all, one more thing before I say most of all, please do come downstairs and join us for a drink after the event in Cafe 54, to get the numbers the right way around. But most of all, I'd like you all to join me in thanking Josh for being a very fantastic contributor.